Hi, this is Bernie Wides, a naturalist, on the air, Heritage Radio Network, and the program is being broadcast live right now. And if you are not listening right now, well, you can get it when it's recorded. Because remember, all of our shows and all the shows on this network are archived, and you could listen to them anytime. So since it's sort of we're into summer now, it's July, and all the plants are blooming, and all the bugs are working, doing their work as pollinators and all that. We're going to talk about some bugs today. But before we get into the bug topic, we have a new sponsor. Our show is sponsored by Acme Smoked Fish. Located in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, Acme has been a mainstay in New York's culinary landscape for over 55 years. Using old-world recipes, Acme produces the finest smoked salmon, whitefish, sable, that discerning palates demand. For information on where to find Acme, Blue Hill Bay, or Ruby Bay products, visit www.acmesmokedfish.com. Okay, and I can personally testify how delicious their smoked fishes are. I love smoked fish. So now we're going to get down to the topic of today, which is bugs, and I'm going to talk about two bugs specifically. The first bug I'm going to talk about is what we call lightning bugs, or fireflies, and we'll get into it, and we'll see that they're not really flies, they're really beetles. And we have a lot of information, and what I'm going to do today is I'm going to quote from a very nice essay from the New York State Conservationist magazine, which is a terrific little magazine, especially for families, because it always has great illustrations in it, and the text is not too thick. For that I mean it isn't overly scientific, and you can get it. I get it every year when I renew my fishing license. I think it's $10 for the year, and you get 12 or 10 issues, and it's very nice. So this particular essay is titled Fireflying, Hunting the Photinus greeneye, which is the Latin name for this specific firefly, by a woman named Lee Stephanie Roscoe. And she starts out talking about looking in her backyard one June evening. She said, I spotted them, little blinking lights twinkling all around. I love it when the fireflies come out. They herald that summer has officially arrived. Now, this show is going to be broadcast on July 5th, I think, and it's not too late to see fireflies because they are out doing their thing all of June and probably most of July. So she says that watching the lights blink here and there, it occurs to me that it looks like Morse code. And in a way, it is. These little insects are communicating with each other, signaling to attract mates. What's amazing is that despite the fact there are approximately 175 different species of fireflies in the U.S., all flashing and blinking in a beautiful yet seemingly arbitrary display, most are able to easily connect with their own species. So when you see all those fireflies blinking, it could be more than one kind. And the way they can tell their own, listen, and here we go. Okay. That's because what appears random to us is actually well choreographed show, with each species flashing the flashes vary in color, in length, and in pattern. This evolutionary adaptation has enabled fireflies to survive throughout the years. But fireflies may be in trouble. Over the past few decades, firefly populations have been declining. I noticed that in my neck of the woods, and wanted to learn more about these fascinating bioluminescent, yes, despite their name, they are beetles, not flies. And we'll talk about bioluminescence. We've already spoken about it in some other shows, but we'll get back to that in a minute. And she says, in my research, I discovered a program called Firefly Watch, being run by the Boston Museum of Science and dedicated to, and she decided to contact this woman, Christine Demery, one of the biologists involved with the project. And I'll tell you more about the project in a few minutes. You may want to join it. Agreeing to let me tag along with her in the field, Christine met me in a local park on a Midsummer's Eve, right after dusk. It was misting, and she was anxious to set out to study the fireflies. We covered our basket in a bug repellent to guard against mosquitoes, but made sure not to leave any on our hands to protect any fireflies we might handle. Christiane donned a miner's lamp, and off we were. So you hear these two women going out in the evening with just the miner's lamp. They look probably like a strange group. We were on the hunt for Photonus greenei. Christina pronounced it greenei, so that's a good way you can remember how to pronounce it. A firefly that only flashes from 8:20 p.m. to 9:45 p.m. As we walked, Christiane described how firefly species have evolved to separate themselves spatially and temporally to avoid confusion between species emitting similar flash patterns. So they separate themselves by distances and temporally, which you'll see in a minute. She explained how the various species divide up the night as well as the summer season, each appearing for about an hour every evening over the course of a fortnight. And a fortnight, I think, as I remember, it's about 2 weeks. And only in certain temperatures, the hottest and moist of the night, the faster most fireflies will flash. Christiane also said that while all fireflies use moist areas, they will separate into niches. A niche is a part of an ecosystem that is specifically where you can find specific animals, always in that niche. For instance, Pyrotechmena prefers stream banks. That's another kind of firefly. Photurus prefer trees, and Photonus prefer wet, grassy areas. Now, I have to stop here and tell you why I decided to do this today, because when I was a kid, we used to go out to Rockaways in the summertime. Rockaways is this barrier beach off Queens, and there were a lot of vacant lots out there. And I used to go around and collect fireflies at night, because they don't fly very fast. And if you have quick movements, you can follow them when they land on a plant and just grab them gently and put them in a jar so you can take them home and observe them for a while. But make sure to let them go the same night, because we don't want to destroy the species. So, and I was walking, I now live in Manhattan near the Hudson River, Riverside Park, and I was walking in the park the other night and I saw the fireflies and I said, boy, it's so great to see them here in Manhattan. So they're really all over the place. Any place where there's some damp woodland and near some water, you'll find the fireflies. Okay, so to go back to her story, arriving at our destination, Christiane flashed her penlight on and off in the correct code to mimic a male greenei seeking out a mate. Two short pulses with a pause of about 1 to 4 seconds between the set. It didn't take long before a light went off in the grass. Christiane bent to the ground, shining the blue miner's lamp down on the grass. She quickly located the Phonetus female, not much bigger than a large black ant, and pointed it out to me. So here they were. They were doing hunting of fireflies. As we continued up the road flashing, Christiane tells me about her background. An evolutionary biologist, she is studying fireflies in part to try to find out how mate selection and predation avoidance drives evolution. You know, predation avoidance means how to avoid predators that want to eat you, and how they are reflected in their morphology and behavior. Okay, so she's doing studies on what they look like. Morphology means the shape of a critter, and their behavior. How do they avoid predation, in other words, being eaten? Okay, so how do females select mates? Do females have a post-mating choice whereby they can actually store and determine which sperm is best and use it to produce an offspring? You know, there are many critters can do that. Butterflies can do that. They'll mate with different, the female will mate with different males, and they can store the sperm and somehow pick out the sperm that's most appropriate to inseminate their eggs with. Christiane confesses to me that it was William Rice's pioneering work on sexual conflict and controlling behaviors in Drosophilas, which are favorite animal for researchers. These are fruit flies, and they use them in laboratories to study life cycles and genetics and all that stuff, because they have a very short lifespan, and their whole lifespan could be 2 weeks. So they could really study their whole lifespan, you know, very easily. So this was the reason she decided to become an evolutionary biologist while still an undergraduate at Mount Holyoke. She wanted to apply Rice's findings to fireflies to see if they were parallel. I just saw Photurus up in the trees, she whispers. We were quiet. Photurus is in many ways the real star of the firefly world. It's a bully, the predator who sets the rules. In most species of fireflies, it is largely the males that fly around flashing while the female perches on nearby vegetation. Not so with Photurus. Females will fly and sometimes mimic the attracting flashing coat of a consenting Photius female to lure unsuspecting males to their death, because in some species, after courtship and copulation, the female will eat the male, because not only is she getting sperm, but she's getting a nice protein-rich male that she can use to provide nourishment for her eggs. And it also makes the adult toxic to predators, because like a lot of butterflies and other critters, fireflies' flesh is toxic. So that's part of their protection. Remember, they're a tiny little bug and they don't want to be eaten. So part of their protection is to incorporate these poisons into the body. And I know with butterflies, especially the monarch, the caterpillar eats milkweed, and milkweed plants are toxic. I don't know how the firefly gets the toxicity, but I'll do another research thing on them, and we'll find out one day. Okay, so she says a truck drives by and a male park ranger sticks his head out and asks if we're okay. It must look pretty weird. Two females by the road flashing a dainty pen light on and off in Morse code. So we said, we're looking for fireflies, Christian assured him before he drove off. Christian then pulls out a thermometer and comments, good, it's above 60 degrees Fahrenheit. Green eye won't come out below that. Then she explains that we still may not see a lot of Photius flashes, because if it spots Photurus, it stops to avoid being predated. So she says sometimes if there's a female around, the males will flash, but sometimes they won't, because they could be eaten. So the woman with her says, is it only Photurus females which are cannibals, she asked. No, we had one Photius male in the lab suck out a Photius blood. Oh, and why are the Photurus males so big as females? Perhaps to avoid predation by its own female. So it's a tricky balancing act here. The males want to copulate with the females, but they have to be very quick and accurate, because if they're not, the female will hang on to them, and as I said, she'll make a dinner out of them. This leads to a discussion about the habits of other local species of fireflies, and I learned that Pyrocantamania, I have a trouble with those Latin names, comes out earlier in the spring than the two main players, perhaps avoiding predation by seasonality as well as by tactics. So Pyrocantamania will dive down suddenly if attacked and flash its code sporadically. Since I've seen this species during the daytime in May, I ask her about timing. Everything's based on rainfall and temperature, so it will be every single night, but it's not consistent, because if the temperature's too low, they can't fly, and if the humidity is not high enough, they just won't fly, Christiane says, careful to qualify everything she tells me. Though certain flashless fireflies may emerge at the end of winter, most flashing species in the Northeast come out between Memorial Day and Labor Day. And the further north you go, the fewer species you'll find. So in our latitude where we live, 40 degrees 48, which is New York City, you can see fireflies almost all summer. So our attention is grabbed by a flash down low. Photurus, Christina tells me, that Photurus is more flexible in its habits as well as its flashes, flying both high and low through various habitats on the prowl. Whoops, one over there too, she whispers. Something's flashing high up in front of me, I say. A small airplane growls overhead, prompting me to ask, do fireflies ever flash at plane lights? And she says the females will flash at anything if they're desperate enough. My headlamp that she wears, remember she's wearing this miner's headlamp, and headlights, she says in a very a whispering voice. Desperation born of brevity, I ask. And, you know, with only a fortnight in which to live, love, and leave offsprings behind, she says she'd be desperate also. Because they have a very short lifespan, as this article says, only about 2 weeks. So as we get in the car to explore some more sites, she tells me that the part of the firefly's back end that lights up is called a lantern. That's a great name for it. And it looks like the light looks like a lantern. And that the chemical reaction that makes it glow is called the luciferin-luciferase reaction. Now, this luciferin-luciferase reaction is in many critters. So nature doesn't waste energy and design. If it has a good design, it sticks to it. So other animals that can glow in the dark, I spoke about these bioluminescent diatoms when I did my show in Puerto Rico. It's the same chemical reaction, luciferin to luciferase. What it does, it oxidizes the luciferin into luciferase, and instead of giving off heat energy, it gives the energy off as light, this beautiful sort of green-blue light. Okay, so after all this, it got too foggy. And so they had to end their evening of looking for different kind of species. And she drove home, she said, in a quiet mood, pondering how such a small light can potentially illuminate so much. And and she felt happy that it was summertime. So this is a very nice little essay. But now I'm going to tell you about that organization that she mentioned, Firefly Watchers. Okay, there's a guy named Don Salvador. He wants fireflies to be around in a century so his kids and grandchildren can see them. To that end, he and the Museum of Science in Boston, Massachusetts, where he works, have teamed up with researchers from Tufts University and Fitchburg State College to conduct a firefly census as a means of tracking these amazing insects. Now, in its second year, the census uses volunteers to observe and report on firefly activity in and near their backyards. Last year, there were 1,500 participants in more than 30 states east of the Rockies, because west of the Rockies, fireflies don't flash. No flashes on the West Coast. So, and he says that firefly populations appear to be declining throughout the U.S. Well, no one knows why for sure. Many feel that habitat change may play a key role. That's for most of our critters, habitat change. Fireflies are sensitive to habitat disturbances and to moisture levels in the soil. In addition, pesticides may be taking a toll on their numbers, and researchers also suspect that artificial light, like street lights, impact the firefly's ability to find a mate. So scientists hope the census will shed light on the geographic distribution of fireflies and their activity during the summer season. Firefly watchers occur at many environmental education centers. For more information, you can contact www.mos.org/firefly watch. So here you see people who are interested in seeing fireflies and looking for them. If you just want to go out and find some and put them in a jar for a little while and look at them, they're really beautiful to look at. They have nice color patterns on it. And I'll put some pictures up on our program, because now we can put pictures up on the same page that the program is in the tags that Jack does so nicely. So remember that fireflies are really not flies. They are beetles. And they like it hot and humid, and if it's under 54 or 60 degrees, just like butterflies, they won't fly. Okay? So they love all different kinds of edges, and I told you I even found them walking right near Riverside Park. And they spend most of their lives, up to 2 years, as grubs. That's the larval stage. And the nighttime light generally occurs during the last 2 weeks of their lives. So while they're grubs, they glow all the time. So you've heard of glowworms? There's a song, Glow Little Glowworm Glow. Well, I saw these glowworms when I was in New Zealand. We went to a cave with a boat in the cave, and it was beautiful. All these firefly lava were glowing, and it was really beautiful. So all firefly lava, called glowworms glow, but not all adult fireflies glow or flash. Light is created, as I said, by an enzyme in the firefly's tail. And species flash displays in various colors, lengths, and patterns of repetition from each other. So that's how, if you're a male firefly or a female, you will flash your own Morse code signal, which will tell that your mate is around, and that nature has done a great job with this, designing these critters, and it's all what Darwin said, many forms most beautiful. So I'm going to stop talking now about the fireflies, because I think we have enough information for now. And as I said, if you want to find out more about them, go to Google or Wikipedia or a textbook, and you could find out more about their lifestyle. But this was just sort of an introduction to them. So next time you go for a walk, even in the city, and there's some bushes or shrubs or something, you may see these lovely little critters flashing their lights. And our show today, I'll remind you again, is Acme Smoked Fish. And what I'm going to do now is I'm going to sign off this segment of the show. And when we come back, I have another bug or critter to talk about, and some updates from our favorite museum, the Museum of Natural History. This is Bernie Wides, the Naturalist, back with the second segment. We spoke about the firefly in the first segment. In the second segment, I'm going to talk about a bug. It's the giant water beetle. And I'll give you the Latin name of it. It has a long Latin name. So it's Lithoceres cordofornis Mayer. And the last word, Mayer, was probably named after the scientist who classified it, because that's what they like to do. So it says, this article is from the Rotunda magazine, which is the magazine of the Museum of Natural History. Comes out every month, has a lot of great articles and all kinds of information, which I'll talk about in a little while. So anyone who has encountered a member of the giant water bug family, and the family name is Bellostomatidae, perhaps while trying to enjoy a nice summer dip in a pool, well, remember why these aquatic insects are commonly called toe biters. They're not shy about hunting prey, even humankind. So, if you see a big water bug, you know, remember they're bigger than cockroaches. Cockroaches never get this big. And water bug in your house or something, they could be nasty. So, just get rid of them however you can. The biggest insects of the order Hemidoptera, a broad group that includes true bugs, as opposed to spiders, cicadas, and hoppers, these aquatic predators are found in shallow streams or ponds across the world, and I can add in buildings. When there is no tasty-looking toe nearby, they generally feed on snails, tadpoles, frogs, small fish, and even small birds. But they don't actually bite. Like all true bugs, they lack chewing mouth parts. Instead, their method of dining involves grabbing prey with their forelimbs, and I'm going to put a great picture of these guys up on the web for you to see, or they're called raptoral forelegs. They're called that because the males use these raptoral forelegs to grab the female and hold her to him while they copulate. So they're called forelimbs or raptoral forelegs. And injecting with a powerful enzyme, which liquefies tissue by breaking down the proteins. So what these little critters do, instead of biting, they inject into an animal or another bug this protein, which starts to break down the tissues. Okay, once their prey turns to mush, water bugs feed by sucking the liquefied remains through a proboscis. Now, proboscis is a feeding tube that a lot of insects have. Instead of having chewing parts in their mouth, they pre-digest their food before they slurp it in, and it ends up like a smoothie. So you could look at your big toe now if you're lying around without shoes on and imagine one of these water bugs wrapped around your toe and injecting this stuff into your toe and trying to actually eat your toe. I mean, they never could really eat your whole toe, but they could make you feel pretty uncomfortable. So I said they suck the liquid through a proboscis. If that sounds agonizing, it is. Water bug bites, even though they're not bites, inflict pain on a par with the top-rated insects on the Schmidt Sting Pain Index. I bet you never knew that there was a Schmidt Sting Pain Index. Jack, did you know that? You didn't know that. Okay, Jack said no. Okay, it's a four-point scale created by entomologist Justin O. Schmidt to compare the stings of the order Hymenoptera, which includes bees, wasps, and ants. But though fairly painful, this sting is not actually dangerous to humans. It's really not dangerous to you because, you know, these critters are relative to your size. They're very small. Okay, so I want you to remember that, and you could amaze your friends when you tell them the story about this bug, and you could tell them their rating on the sting and the Schmidt Sting Pain Index. I thought that was a joke, but it really is. Okay? Their bites, or stings, however you want to say, are up there with bees and wasps. The water bug's other nickname, electric light bugs, comes from their attraction to light. Though they are clumsy flyers, water bugs do take to the air when seeking out new streams and rely on surface light bouncing off the water to find their way. So that's good. It's a full moon night, you can be sure they'll be out because the light of the moon reflects onto the water. Just like the light of the moon is reflected onto the moon from the sun, then it's reflected on the water. If you've ever been out on a full moon night, out on the water like I have canoeing at night, you know, you can see fairly well. Not terrifically, but you can see what direction you're going. And, of course, there's plenty of light reflected from the water surface, especially if it's very calm. Okay, when humans bring electric lights to a new area that include water bug habitats, the two species inevitably collide. So remember, if you're moving into the habitat of the water bugs, or it's moving into yours, into your building where you live, then you're going to collide, and they may find your toe pretty tasty. Species of this bug occur worldwide, but this particular specimen from the museum's Department of Entomology, a male Lethoceras cordofanus Meyer, was collected in 1911 in Morogoro, Tanzania. Though nearly a century old, like most insects, its hard body preserves well without any special treatment. It's one of the approximately 24 million specimens housed in the Museum Division of Invertebrate Zoology. So if you want to find out more about this bug or on the museum's collection, they probably have every bug that's currently known on Earth. And, you know, the order of insects is huge. There are many, many, many more insects than there are of other orders like mammals and other critters. Okay, probably the only thing that's more numerous on Earth than insects are bacteria. Okay, so I thought you'd be interested in hearing about these bugs that could bite your toe. And now that you look at your toe differently when you walk around barefoot, but you don't really have to worry because if there's enough food around, they won't bother you at all. But I've heard cases of where they take up residence in houses. And if you see a great big water bug in your house, well, just send it on its way. So I'm going to talk about some other bug-related stuff since it's summertime and all the bugs are out roaming around, reproducing, doing their stuff, flashing like fireflies, singing like cicadas, and humming like bees. So here's one called hors d'oeuvres, anyone? Water bugs may be fierce predators who feast on aquatic life, but they often become prey also, sometimes to humans. Lethoceras bugs, which are the ones we've been talking about, are considered delicacies and are served both fresh and cooked in parts of Asia, including Vietnam and Thailand. They are also used to make a spicy condiment. Now, I can testify to something similar to this. When I was in Australia and we stopped at a national park near Ayers Rock, there was a ranger giving a talk on, foraging for foods. If you were out in the great outback of Australia and you had to find things to eat, if you were with somebody who lived out there, like one of the Aborigine folks, you could find food. And one of the foods they found was a larva of a bug called witchetty bugs. And witchetty bugs' larva are about 2 inches long, maybe sometimes 3 inches long. And what the ranger did, he got some for us. They were in rotting wood, and he cracked the wood open, and there were these grubs. And you've probably seen grubs like this locally also in rotting wood. If you do a lot of walking in the forest, and you might even kick over a dead branch, and it falls apart, you could find grubs inside of it. So these grubs are good to eat. And this natural park guy showed us, he took the bugs and he roasted them quickly on a fire, and they became very crisp. And then he served it to us. And of course I had to try it. I went all the way from the United States to New Zealand and Australia, and here he was in Australia, I had to try an indigenous food. So actually, they just had a nice crunchy taste. I think if you dipped them in a sauce, they're like shrimp, they would taste better. So remember that. People all over the world eat all kinds of sources of protein. And while we in the United States are very lucky that we have a lot of protein and all that, there are a lot of people who subsist on finding foraging for food and must subsist like that. Okay, now I'm going to talk about another interesting little fact from the museum. And this is called the Kinsey Connection. The largest part of the division of invertebrate zoology collection is the Alfred A. Kinsey collection of cynopedia, or gall wasps. Kinsey, who is best known for his research on human sexuality, began collecting gall wasps for his doctoral thesis at Harvard, and even published an article about gall wasp life cycles for the Bulletin of the American Museum of Natural History in 1920. His extensive collection, which includes some 7 million specimens, was donated to the museum by Kinsey's wife in 1958. Now, I don't know if you saw, there was a movie, I think, and there was a show, a Broadway show made about Kinsey. And he did a lot of valuable research on human sexuality and animal sexuality. But he, when he started out his science career, he was an entomologist. And he was really a serious entomologist, and he established this huge collection. But when he died, his wife donated it to the museum. And he had 7 million specimens. Now, most bugs are pretty small, so you could keep 7 million specimens probably in a rack of drawers somewhere. But that's how the museum has accumulated a lot of its collection from people who are collectors. And I know personally from working in the butterfly vivarium, which now is closed and will reopen in October, that at the entrance of the butterfly vivarium, we have part of the collection from this famous Russian novelist, Nabokov, who wrote a book, Lolita, and other books. And he worked as an entomologist at the Museum of Natural History, too. So many famous people have had careers starting at the museum. I think it's A.O. Wilson, the famous ant guy. He, I think, did a lot of work at the museum, and he's probably still on the staff as, maybe as a retired member, or maybe he's actually still working. I don't really know, but every once in a while we hear of A.O. doing writing a paper or doing something. So we have about 2 minutes left now to this show, and I want to tell you about some activity at the museum coming up this summer, because the museum doesn't take the summer off. I'm going to take off 5 weeks and travel to the National Marine Educators Conference in Gatlinburg, Tennessee. So you may say, why are the marine educators meeting in Gatlinburg? It's because every year we meet in a different part of the country. And in Gatlinburg, we're going to do limnology, which is studying about freshwater instead of saltwater. But it should be a good time, and I'll try to record some lectures for you folks to play when I come back. And by the way, in the next couple of weeks, Jack's going to play some talks that I recorded at the New York State Marine Educators Conference. There's a terrific talk by Steve, one of the artists at the museum, who's a fisherman on Long Island, and he talks about catching fish. And before he eats them, he makes them into fish prints. If you've ever seen Japanese fish prints, you know they're beautiful. He takes the fish, he paints it with a soluble ink, and presses rice paper onto it, and pulls it off, and there you have a beautiful print of the scales and the eye and one side of the fish. So Steve was at our conference with his work, and another great lecture was a guy named Markowitz. I don't remember his last name, but he spoke about all the strategies of the city to try to prevent rainwater from running off into the sewer treatment plants. And this was really fascinating. Something like called permeable pavement he was talking about. And then, you know, the Million Tree campaign of Mayor Bloomberg, part of that is to soak up water as well as to provide shade. Okay, so some of the things at the museum, I think I have 1 minute left. These are in July. We have the virtual universe. It's called the Explosive Universe with Jack Faraday, who works at the museum. And this is a tour of the Milky Way to observe where stars are born and to see everything energetic in between. So that's about the creation of the universe, how the stars came into being and all that. And that'll be on Tuesday night, July 6th. Another great thing that you may want to go to was there's one in July called Wild Wild World, a live penguin show at the museum. You know, we have this great show now about Antarctica. So they're going to have some live penguins at the museum, and that will be on Saturday, July 10th. From 11 to noon, and also again from 1 to 2, and join TV host Jared Miller and live penguins to learn about animals that live in extreme environments. And you know Antarctica is really an extreme environment. And I'm going to do a show after the summer about our exhibit called The Race to the Ends of the Earth, where there was this competition between the British team and the Norwegian team who would reach the South Pole first. And it's really a great exhibit. If you can get to the museum this summer, get to see it. And that gallery that it's in is always cold, so you can feel like you're walking into Antarctica to see that show. That's called Race to the Ends of Earth, and it'll be at the museum until January 2nd. So you have plenty of time to go to see it. Also, if you want a nice outdoor activity, we have evening bat walks in Central Park. So there's going to be one on July 16th, Friday, July 16th. Friday, July 23rd, and Friday, July 30th. Join Brad Klein and Danielle Gustafson and other members of the New York City Bat Group for a walk through Central Park in search of bats. Rain or shine? Oh, the rain date is on the Saturday of that weekend. So the New York Bat Group are folks who are interested in bats. And when I was teaching years ago, when I was teaching woodworking out on Long Island, I had my kids make bat boxes. And what are bat boxes? They're like birdhouses, but they're made specifically for bats. And I had my kids take them home and hang them up, except some parents were a little upset. They didn't want to attract any bats to their yard, so we didn't do it. But, you know, bats are relatively harmless. They never get in your hair. They do echolocation, and they're very, very good at it, which means it's like seeing in the dark. So you don't have to worry about bats. But if you want to try to see some in Central Park, they'll take you to Central Park, and I know the place they'll take you. It's at the Turtle Pond near the Delacorte Theater, because there are bats living on those high cliffs around that pond. So that's another nice thing to see. And our great Silk Road exhibit is still on. It'll be there through August 15th, and you should try to get there to see it. And it says in the brochure, step back 1,000 years in time to experience the sights, sounds, and stories of the greatest trading route in history, the Silk Road. And the Silk Road ran from Baghdad in Iraq all the way to China. And with that, I'll leave you the last one I want to talk about, Snakes and Lizards Alive, which will be there till September. And as I said, I am going to be away a couple of weeks, but this show is coming on July 5th, I think. And after that, You can listen to some of these great interviews I did at the conference, and Jack will repeat some shows. If you want to hear a specific show that I've done before, what you can do is you can get in touch with the network at info@heritageradionetwork.com, and you could say, please, on the naturalist, repeat the show on bats or the ones that I did on the anglerfish or whatever. So this is Bernie Wide signing off, and our sponsor today was Acme Smoked Fish.